Hi, this is Katya, executive producer of On The Media. I have some news for you. Brooke wrote a book, and it's out this week, officially. It's called The Trouble With Reality, A Rumination on the Moral Panic in Our Time. And in it, Brooke explores the idea that we are living in an era of smoke and mirrors as never before. Basic facts have no impact, and fundamental norms are violated at will. How did we get here? In the book, you follow Brooke down a rabbit hole as she searches for an explanation. Our colleague Brian Lehrer, host of WNYC's Live Morning Show, spoke with Brooke on Tuesday about the book. It was a great conversation. Here's Brian.
You compare the two classic books, 1984 by George Orwell and Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, through the lens of the late NYU Media Studies professor Neil Postman. Mm-hmm. Both those books describe totalitarian worlds we could find ourselves in, but one of them struck Postman as more relevant to today, and I think struck you that way too. Will you take us there?
Sure, absolutely. Postman was writing about this in his 1985 classic book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, which still has a great deal to teach us, even though it does precede the internet and the impact of digital technology. And I think some of the things that he projects are off. But in terms of the Orwell-Huxley comparison, here's what he wrote. He wrote, "What Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared was that there would be no reason to ban a book, for there would be no one who wanted to read one. Orwell feared those who would deprive us of information. Huxley feared those who would give us so much information that we would be reduced to passivity and egoism. Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared that the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared that we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared that we would become a trivial culture, preoccupied with the equivalent of the feelies, the orgy porgy, and the centrifugal bumble puppy." In 1984, Orwell added, "People are controlled by inflicting pain. In Brave New World, they are controlled by inflicting pleasure." In short, Orwell feared that what we hate will ruin us. Huxley feared that what we love will ruin us.
It was that last one that really stopped me short in my tracks when I was reading the book. In 1984, Orwell added, "People are controlled by inflicting pain. In Brave New World, they're controlled by inflicting pleasure." And it's that that you say was the world that led us ineluctably to the election of Donald Trump.
Absolutely. How could it be otherwise? I mean, Trump's campaign was an endless stream of comedy and melodrama, apocalypse and deliverance. It was incredibly entertaining, no matter what your politics were. To some, it was enthrallingly frank, I wrote. But to others, ultimately, Trump's victory shattered reality. And it was much more than about a political outcome you didn't like or a president you didn't respect or even feared. If you live long enough, you're bound to have those experiences many times over your life. And you can feel a kind of dread. But what I was hearing in our Eastern elite bubble, in our cohort, and basically from cities all around the country, because it seems to be a city-country thing even more than a policy or a party thing, was that this sense of dread was more extreme, more chilling, more disabling, because it got to the core of our beliefs of how the world worked. And so I decided to, you know, take a deep dive into trying to figure out exactly how do we construct the worlds we live in? Why do we construct those worlds? Is it even possible to see past the boundaries of our own infinite bubbles? And I honestly think it isn't like there are two in this country. I think there are as many bubbles as there are individuals. They are bespoke. They are handcrafted. And we craft them for a reason. And we've been doing it for as long as we've existed.
Another reference from the book. You quote the English poet John Milton, most famous for Paradise Lost, in a polemic against censorship to the British government in the 1700s. that inspired Thomas Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you now find it naive.
Right. Yeah. Well, here's the thing, is that what Milton said and what Jefferson later echoed was that if you place truth in a battle with falsehood, truth will always win. Milton believed that the people fundamentally grew wise with exposure to information. And Jefferson certainly believed this. Now, not all the founding fathers did. Madison didn't really believe it. Hamilton certainly didn't. And the fact is that we know now that information does not lead to a higher truth. We create our worlds from the seen and the unseen. The seen are the facts, but until they are marinated in our traditions and our values, until we place them into a narrative context that we agree with, all of those things, and we leave out the ones that don't fit, information alone won't do it. Fact-checking alone won't stop Trump. The only way to stop Trump, if you want to stop Trump, is to make sure that those facts can fit into the lives of people who don't agree with you. In other words, you have to place them in a context, you have to explain their relevance, and then you have to wait. Yes, you have to wait for the world to bear you out.
But if the argument in the 1700s that inspired Jefferson and others was that censorship is bad because more information leads to good political decision making.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we certainly have more information in today's world than we've ever had before,
mm-hmm.
and there is no shortage of bad political decision making. But are you suggesting that some of the very best values of our nation, because the First Amendment was based on this idea, are based on utopian wishful thinking and are bound to fail us?
Well, what are values? Values are our better angels. They don't necessarily reflect what's in the real world. But we have to understand that these are not mechanical principles. This is not physics. This is philosophy. We want to believe that information will make us better people, a more informed electorate, as Jefferson would say. But many people, including John Adams, and I quote him towards the end of the book, he says, remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. The passions are the same in all men under all forms of simple government, and when unchecked, produce the same effects of fraud, violence, and cruelty. Individuals have conquered themselves, nations and large bodies of men never. In other words, we believe it is a liberal principle. It is one of our foundational beliefs that democracy is the best system and democracy works. And what did we see in this election? A sense that it didn't work, that something went wrong. And I examine the role of the press. I examine the masterful use of alternate forms of information and actually casting doubt on the very possibility of knowing reality. I mean, when Trump says that all of the organs of accountability, whether it's the Congressional Budget Office or the media, are simply other special interest groups with their own agenda, and that you don't believe them, you shouldn't believe them, you don't have to believe them. You can pick who you want to believe based on absolutely nothing more than your inclination, because the truth cannot be known. The truth, if you support me, is what I say it is today, and whatever I say it is tomorrow, support me too, because I've made you some promises and that's our deal, right? And so that's what we're confronted with. This is different from the Bush administration, which many people threw their hands up at because they were offering an alternate reality. But it was a consistent one and a stable one. It was Karl Rove who told the New York Times reporter Ron Suskind that you and the reality-based community have to understand that we're going to be throwing realities at you as we choose, and you're just going to have to deal with that. But the departure for Trump is that he is throwing at us the idea that there is no reality or that it's optional, just build your own.
The most interesting part of your book for me, I think, was the Hannah Arendt section.
Mm.
Hannah Arendt, the Hitler and Stalin era political theorist, who said would-be totalitarian rulers usually start their careers by boasting of their past crimes and carefully outlining their future ones. That is so Trumpian, it's creepy. And she wrote that in 1951?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she did, in a book chillingly titled The Origins of Totalitarianism. Now, I want to say that I am not comparing Trump to Hitler or his followers to Nazis. I am talking purely about Arendt's description of how the Nazis, and particularly Hitler, used the engines of media, used rhetoric, and spoke to a disaffected population that had been ignored for generations, or at least a really bad generation of being ignored, in order to create an immense constituency. And the kinds of rhetoric that was used were very bear such strong parallels to what we saw in the past election. Again, I'm not saying to the same end. I'm simply saying the techniques are really illustrative and they're worth taking a look at. And she took a very close look and missed nothing.
So you're right that once again, the so-called carnival barker seized a mallet and smashed an essential stereotype that our democracy was based on a set of shared values. You mean we couldn't even agree as a nation that these things most New Yorkers found hateful were even bad?
The thing is that there was a bargain. There was, yeah, you know, I think that if you said, do we believe that everyone is equal, probably everyone in the country would believe that. But what they see with their eyes is a sense of being ignored while all the media attention is on, you know, immigrants and people in the inner city being shot. And, hey, what about us? We're here. We don't have jobs. We're dying at higher rates from opioid addiction and gun violence and so on. It's a sense that there's complete chaos, and there's also a sense, I believe, of entitlement, that they deserve this attention before it goes to anybody else, especially any recent immigrants to the United States. And here's the thing. I'm not saying listen to these people, understand them, see if you can find some common ground. No, I'm not saying that. You have values. I have values. I will cling to them. I have to have them and hold fast to them. But all I know is that many of our fundamental beliefs about how things work got smashed. And if you want to ease that sense of unsettlement, then you have to figure out how to paste your world back together, create a more durable reality. And the only way you can do that is if you figure out what actually happened and why, and that necessitates going out and listening to what people say.
Another Hannah Arendt. You say Arendt? Arendt. I've always said Hannah Arendt, but that's probably from total ignorance.
I don't know if I'm saying it right.
Hannah Arendt. I'm going with yours. Another Hannah Arendt quote you include is, "The spokesmen for totalitarian movements possessed an unerring instinct for anything that ordinary party propaganda or public opinion did not care to touch. The mob really believed the truth was whatever respectable society had hypocritically passed over or covered with corruption." And the modern masses do not believe in anything visible. What convinces masses are not facts and not even invented facts, but only the consistency of the system of which they are presumably part. So creepily eerie to what we're seeing now, or as you deeply analyze it in the book, yikes.
Well, the thing is, you know, I was uncomfortable with her using the term masses, although it was much more commonly used both for the right and the left. I mean, one great left-wing magazine was called the Modern Masses, yeah. I believe, or the Masses. But in this case, she's talking about the followers of Hitler. But I think that we all long for consistency in our positions, and we are all loath to change. And there is a whole lot of interesting data that suggests that, because our realities are built on a web of beliefs. Fundamentally, they have found there was a study of visitors to a site about climate change, and it was a well-conducted study, and they found that people who had a strong belief in the free market did not have a strong belief in climate change. Well, you can imagine why. There's a relationship there. They also didn't have a strong belief in HIV causing AIDS. They also didn't have a strong belief in smoking causing cancer. All of these things can be traced back to this strong foundational belief in the free market. You can't have that and science happening at the same time if one is going to call the other one into challenge. That is that web of beliefs I'm talking about. And don't think this just happens on the right.
So you describe a classic authoritarian deal that Trump made to his followers. And I think you were just alluding to this. And again, not to suggest in you quoting Hannah Arendt that Trump wants to be Hitler or wants to be Stalin, but it's still a classic authoritarian deal in type with his supporters. You write, "You can bask in my favor and recognition in the promises I make and the license I bestow. And all I ask in return is that you believe whatever I say whenever I say it, even when it is false, even when it contradicts the reality of your own experience." Arendt saw that in her time too.
Right, absolutely. And why? Because if you catch me in a lie tomorrow, it doesn't matter. You'll just wink. You're in on the joke. Because the facts really don't matter. Because, as I said, the truth is a liar.
Do you think anyone ever said, "I take Hitler seriously, but not literally"?
Well, we certainly know that the coverage of Hitler was very derisive and no one took him seriously until it was too late.
There is just one quote that I noticed you used twice in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me why this is that important. It's from Walter Lippmann, the newspaper man from 100 years ago. And he says in the 1920s, "If the newspapers are to be charged with the duty of translating the whole public life of mankind so that every adult can arrive at an opinion on every moot topic, they fail. They are bound to fail in any future one can conceive. They will continue to fail." Fail at what?
To really grab hold of the people and to inform them. The reason why it appears in two places, Brian, is because in the early part of the book, I talk about one of our foundational beliefs that was shattered, which is that information will lead to wisdom. Because it's foundational because our founding fathers did believe it, and they created laws in order to that were based entirely on that, that are uniquely American. The First Amendment, obviously, exists because the founding fathers were convinced that wisdom emerged from information. They codified civil liberties to ensure that our speech and press were free. But the thing is that even though it saw the press as a vital institution, it didn't support it like a vital institution. It was still a business. And as Lippmann complained in the 20s, people don't like to pay for information. Even then, they like to pay for entertainment. And it was entertainment that kept the presses rolling, and it was entertainment that became the tail that was wagging the dog of actual useful information. And then I used it again because we jump ahead to now, and we see a time, a great moment that I think many in the media have been waiting for since Craigslist began and since newspapers started posting their information online for free, which is that if you want high-quality information, if you want information that you can trust, from people that you trust, even if they do make mistakes sometimes, then you have to pay for it. This is an idea that went entirely out of fashion. We've always been able to pay for entertainment. When I was a kid, TV was free. Now we all pay for TV. We pay to be entertained, mostly. And, I mean, it's ESPN that makes the most money. So in this case, people—
And even they just had a lot of people off.
Well, there you go.
Because everything's going to the web.
Yeah. We have increasingly moved towards free information, where we can get it, no matter what the quality is, we'll just grab it and consume it like entertainment, something else Neil Postman worried about back in the 80s. But now we realize we have to pay for it. And as a result, ailing great news organizations are staffing up. The Times, The Post, public radio is stronger, I think, than it's ever been. Certainly WNYC has been the beneficiary of listeners realizing that they need this stuff. They want this stuff. And I repeated it again because right now the media have taken on Trump with the strength of the people who are supporting them, their audience. And should the audience fall away, then that engine of accountability will run out of gas again, and it will just sputter into disuse, and there won't be any engines of accountability. Right now, the trust in the media is so low in Republican echo chambers. I think it's down to 14%. I think it's 51% among Democrats.
So the second time you use the Lippman quote, it's in the context of the Washington media growing a spine in the era of Trump, as you were just laying out. Information, investigation, clarity, less giving equal weight to false equivalencies for the sake of looking balanced.
Mm-hmm.
But you wonder whether Lippman would laugh or cheer or cry. Why?
Well, he was cynical about the prospects of the media carrying the whole load. He said the problem isn't just that the media is a business. The problem is that the other institutions of accountability in the government, the ones that are supposed to generate data and keep us informed, don't work very well. And of course, under the current president, a lot of the organizations that produced data, you know, ranging from the EPA to the Congressional Budget Office, have been hobbled. So we'll be seeing less and less data. The Census Bureau chief recently left. That's a disaster. It's not something we're going to go into here, but the fact is that is information that absolutely strengthens our democracy, and all you have to do is choke off the funds, and there that goes. The media can't carry that whole load. Now, I have to say that something that wasn't around in Lippman's time was data journalism and computer and digital technology. The media can pick up more than that, but again, it is expensive.
There's a cliche that used to feel like an act of resistance. It was the internet wants to be free.
Yeah.
So, on the one side, open source values versus the corporatization of the web, yes. But on the other side, journalism is dying in the post-newspaper world because the internet has no business model. Yeah.
Information wants to be free meant unfettered. It didn't mean without a price. You know, I was told by a number of people who have read the book that although there isn't a solution and I'm not trying to calm anybody down, just placing this moment in a historical perspective offers a kind of consolation. You realize we've been here before as a species, even as a nation, and the Republic survived. So there's that. I have that going for me anyway.
I had that experience reading the book too. It's somehow at once comforting and activating to see the intellectual context and the deep thinking that you did and research to give us the deep historical, sort of the intellectually historical or the history of political philosophy that underlies why we are where we are right now. You conclude this book by saying activism is not enough. You have to travel out of your moral comfort zone into the world of others. And after your book has referenced all these cultural touchstones, Orwell, Hannah Arendt, John Adams, Ursula Le Guin, Walter Lippmann, Huxley's Brave New World, the final cultural reference in the book is Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift. Why Gulliver's Travels and that we are the irrational Yahoo people from that story, not the the logical horses of that story governed by reason?
It was trying to understand the value in what we do in our world creation, that we can't live as the horses did, the hermeneims or whatever their names were, these gloriously rational horses that had really no familial feeling, no religion, no art, no storytelling, no vanity. They were pure rationality, and it's a cold, cold life. They never reflected on their lives. When it was time to die, they trotted off to die, and that was that. Humans don't live that way. They have to weave the seen and the known with the unseen and the unknown to create a more complete world. And the Yahoos were the most primal lizard-brained id, Cro-Magnon type expression of that. They were nothing but impulse. It was like the whole human being divided in two parts. And then there was a third inhabitant of the realms that Gulliver traveled that I'd completely forgotten about, which were the Laputans. And these were philosophers of science who lived on an island floating in the sky. And literally, they can't see straight. One eye is focused up, one eye is focused down. They had to hire people to gently strike the mouth of the man who was supposed to speak and the ear of the one who was supposed to listen, and to hold on to his master so that he didn't just walk into the street or fall down a hole, because they were so detached from the world in their speculations. And they didn't know how to work in the world at all. They built lopsided homes, clothes that didn't make sense. They were so oblivious to the results and so smugly ensured of their own superiority that they were both quite brilliant and quite stupid. And that's what happens when you focus on abstraction and systems and don't continually refresh your view of the world that you actually live in, which means stepping out of the unseen creation into what you can see, and not just what you can see around you, but what you, with the help of our endless media, our boundless ability to peer elsewhere, read into the minds of other people who are so utterly foreign to you.
And that's ultimately in this rumination that your book is on unshared realities that strikes many pessimistic notes. Mm-hmm. You conclude that there is a path, maybe not to agreement, but at least to comprehension. And so the last line of your book is, if we really look, we might see that other reality reflected in that person's eyes, and therein lies the beginning of the end of our reality problem. So you're not such a pessimistic fatalist after all.
Hey, I mean, you have a choice. You can give up or you can keep striving. I mean, all of the people saying we must resist must understand that there's an external resistance, but there's also a resistance one can wage against one's own smug surety, our own tunnel vision, not that it even has to change you, but so that you really know what you're fighting against and how best to know what you're fighting for.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast extra. The Trouble with Reality, a rumination on the moral panic in our time, is out this week and available in bookstores near you.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.